Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and those who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. This is Season 2, sponsored by Park Road Books, the oldest and only independent bookstore in Charlotte. I don't know about you, but I get a good feeling when I'm surrounded by a world of new books, and an even better feeling when I know I'm supporting the local independent bookstore. Consider stopping by Park Road Books for your feel-good experience. You'll meet a friendly staff ready to recommend that next great read, just for you. Speaking of feeling good, I've got a good feeling that you will enjoy our guest author today. So let's get to it. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. In this episode, author Tommy Tomlinson, finalist for the 2005 Pulitzer Prize in Commentary and longtime local columnist with the Charlotte Observer, reads from The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. Tommy reads and talks about his lifetime struggle with his weight. It's at times humorous and full of wit, and at times it's full of depth and tugs at your heart, but always, always filled with that human touch that makes Tommy a writer worth reading. In addition to reading from and talking about many sections of his new book, Tommy adds a bonus. He reads a story he wrote about a Charlotte boy named Sammy Johns who wrote the 1970s hit Chevy Van, and even sings a verse or two. We start this episode with Tommy reading Here Comes the Bride and One Lucky Guy. It's a column he wrote on his wedding day that some people still carry around with them, and it appears in the book The Elephant in the Room, published by Simon & Schuster.
This piece was titled Here Comes the Bride and One Lucky Guy. Unless I screw up between now and I will, sometime around 6:30 this evening, I will become a married man. Little problems mean nothing today. If I lose the rings, we'll use tinfoil. If I forget my tux, I'll go naked. If I have a flat tire, I'll jog to the service. And my bride-to-be knows how much I hate jogging. Alexandra Dawn Felsing, she goes by Alex, knows a lot of other things about me. She knows I like to stack my towels in an alternating pattern, colored, white, colored, white. She knows I wiggle my right foot when I get excited, like a dog getting his belly rubbed. She knows I cry more than the average guy. I know things about her, too. I know how her eyes light up when she finds a cool piece of fabric at Mary Jo's in Gastonia. I know how she ditched piano lessons as a kid to go outside and play softball. I know how she likes her privacy and is probably getting twitchy just thinking about these words on the page. We're opposites in so many ways. I'm from Georgia, she's from Wisconsin. I like bright, shiny colors, she likes browns and greens. I like music, she likes Neil Diamond. But we have lots in common, too. We think the Lord invented summer nights for minor league baseball and created newspapers as a place to put the comic strips. Lately, we also have the habit of just staring at each other, amazed that all this is really happening, astonished that the fullness in our hearts is not a trick of nature or a fleeting attraction, but the soft, steady drumbeat of love. I always hoped I would find someone and we would fall in love. But I didn't think I had much to offer, especially in those first few moments where you make an impression or you slink back across the room. I came to believe I was just a fat guy with bad teeth, and I pretty much quit trying. The only reason my heart didn't get broken is because I rarely took it out of the box. Alex and I had both worked here at the Observer for years, but the paper has offices in several towns, and we never worked in the same place. Last summer, I found out she was moving away. I knew her just well enough to want to say goodbye. I visited her office in Hickory. We went to a ball game that night, then a party that weekend. Then she left town, and I couldn't stop thinking about her. Still, I planned to let it go, long-distance romances don't work. That's what I told myself. But what I really believed was, she's out of my league. But a few days later, she sent me a thank you note. It took me 2 days to muster the guts to write back. I filled the letter with escape hatches and exit doors, giving her every chance to let me down easy. But somehow I sputtered out that I had been thinking romantic thoughts about her. A couple of days later, I got a note from her saying she had been thinking the same thing. I got up off the floor and called her. And here we are. I don't pretend to know how love works. I could tell you a thousand things I love about Alex, but none of them are exactly why I love her. The why I don't have words for. It's a code we decipher every time we hold hands. A secret song we hear when we look in each other's eyes. It's really true. You just know. The point of this is not to brag about my good fortune. It's simply to say that no matter how lonely you are, no matter how much you think you've missed your chance, there is hope. Always hope. Everlasting hope. Today, my fondest hopes come true. And sometime around 6:30 this evening, I'll become the luckiest man alive.
Tommy Tomlinson spent 23 years as a reporter and local columnist for the Charlotte Observer, where he was a finalist for the 2005 Pulitzer Prize in Commentary. He's written for publications including Esquire, ESPN the Magazine, Sports Illustrated, Forbes, Gardening Gun, and many others. His stories have been chosen twice for the Best American Sports Writing series, 2012 and 2015. He also appears in the anthology America's Best Newspaper Writing. His book, The Elephant in the Room, a memoir about life as an overweight man in a growing America, has received excellent reviews. His book tour starts this evening, January 15th, at Park Road Books in Charlotte, and continues through April. Tommy is also the host of the podcast Southbound in partnership with WFAE, Charlotte's NPR station. He's taught at Wake Forest University as well as other colleges, workshops, and conferences across the country. And he's a graduate of the University of Georgia and a 2008-2009 Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Tommy and his wife, Alex Felsing, live in Charlotte. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lannis. Thanks for having me.
I asked you to read this piece first because although it's in the middle of the book, and I think it's the only column you wrote that is in the book, it highlights a person, Alex, with whom your struggle might not have been the same without.
Certainly would have been much worse and not completely sure I'd have been able to get past it without her. She is been the one constant in all of this, and I've made her life worse in some ways, I think, and caused her to make a lot of sacrifices, but I hope in the end that it's been worth it for her, and it's certainly been worth it for me.
Well, you talk in your book, and the book I'm talking about here is The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America, which you're going to be reading from today. You set this wedding day column up by talking about the fact that you never felt any woman you'd ever dated was going to stay, and you felt like Alex might stay, but you wanted to warn her. You said, "I'm damaged goods," and she said, "No, you're not." So you're thinking negatively, she's thinking positively. Has that been a theme in your life?
Well, I think both of us,
because it doesn't come across in your writing. You know?
Well, I think both of us would say that there are times when she's a positive one and I'm the negative one. Yeah. And there are other times when it's swapped.
Yeah, yeah.
I think certainly when it comes to my weight and my sort of self-image, that I have been pretty negative most of my life about those things. And she has really bucked me up and made me think and feel much more positively about my body and the way I look and the way I move around in the world. So on that particular issue, she's definitely been the positive one in my life.
This thing you've been dealing with, the obesity all your life, did it drive you into some dark places?
Well, sure. I mean, I not only just what you were talking about, that I didn't think I would find anybody. I didn't think I was really worthy of, love or being loved. That's probably the biggest thing. But but certainly just kind of day to day, I talk a good bit about in the book that there are things that I never have experienced that just about everybody else has experienced. You know, I've never rode a bike because I never learned, because my legs were kind of too big to do the pedals when I was a kid. So there are a lot of little check marks like that that most people accomplished easily at different points in their lives that I didn't. And I feel like those things certainly are things I missed out on and things I felt bad about myself about because of my weight.
I was talking to Sally Brewster, the owner of Park Road Books, today about coming over to have this conversation. And I told you you were going to read this piece at the outset of the show. And she said, oh, I love that piece. It made me cry and so forth. And here's my question. You say in the book that people sometimes carry this around with them. Do you carry it around and pull it out sometimes? Say, hey, Alex, don't forget. What I wrote here.
we have it framed on the office wall.
So you can always point to it.
We can always point to it and say, look, here's what I meant.
Yeah.
It's like the...
I know I said this, but here's what I really meant.
No, it's like the lifetime guarantee. You know, I'm going to hold myself to this. And we have it. I see it every single day.
That's great. So we're going to talk about the elephant in the room, and we're going to do it by having you read a number of short segments from the book. But before we do that, I'd like to talk about the title just a moment. Double meaning, obesity, and perhaps yourself?
Sure. I mean, I think literally I felt like that a lot, especially in crowds or in, you know, situations where there are a lot of people around. I'm always the biggest person in any room I'm in. And so I always feel very conspicuous and often like I'm in the way, you know, those sorts of things. And so that's certainly one part of that meaning. And the other part is that I think of it in a more, you know, universal sense, that obesity is this huge problem in this country that we haven't really figured out how to fix. And in fact, most of the trends are going in the opposite direction. We keep getting bigger and bigger, and at the same time, our portion sizes keep getting bigger, and the amount of junk food that's available to us is more and more plentiful, and the advertising that pushes all those things into our stores and onto our tables is more and more ubiquitous. And so
that's America getting bigger.
That's America getting bigger, and that's another elephant in the room, is that that's something that we, not just in this country, but other countries, but certainly in America, probably more than anywhere else, is a problem that we have to deal with, not just in terms of our health, but in the cost that it brings, the medical costs. And I think I quote somewhere early on that the amount of money we spend year to year with medical treatment for obesity is about equivalent to the budget for the U.S. Army.
Wow.
And so it's this huge amount of money that we're spending. So for practical reasons alone, it would do us good to be healthier.
So how long have you been on this quest to get smaller?
Well, in one sense, my whole life. You know, since I was a little kid, I've always been fat. I've always been overweight. And since I was probably 9 or 10 at least, I can remember being on different diets, being on different exercise programs, you know, from going to see a diet doctor who basically, I think, gave me mostly amphetamines, you know, to, you know, all kinds of different fad diets and things like that, to Weight Watchers, all the normal programs that you and your listeners might know about. And so I would do each of those things for a little while, and then I would backslide. And I'd do some for a little while, and then I'd quit. And part of what this book is about is a search for something that would enable me to lose weight and get in shape sustainably. Because I think one of the big problems for everybody is that, you know, as I say, I think just about every diet is good in the short term. Almost no diets work in the long term.
Yeah, we're going to talk about
because
dieting.
And so my part of this search in this book was for something I could stick with.
All right. So your chapters, you have a little tracker going there in the chapters about your weight. And I'm not going to ask you what your weight is now or how it came out, because we've got to leave something to imagination here for the readers. But still, I didn't feel that that was what the book was about. I mean, I was interested to see what was going on at the chapters, but I think the book was more about your struggle. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. In fact, we talked ahead of time. You know, I was kind of writing this book in real time as I was trying to lose weight and get in shape. And one of the things I discussed with my agent, my editor, was, so what if I don't lose any weight? Yeah. Or what if I don't lose much weight? Or whatever. And after some discussion, we decided just what you said, is that the book isn't really not about getting to a number. You know, it's not about saying I'm going to lose 100 pounds this year or whatever. It was about the struggle and the things in the way of that struggle and the things in my life in particular that contributed to that struggle and how I try to sort all those things out, trying to understand myself better. And along the way, I wanted to give people a sense of how I was progressing or regressing, as the case might be sometimes, just to show, you know, I'm making the effort and here's how it's going so far. But certainly that was not the end all and be all of the book.
Simon & Schuster, your publisher, put out this comment about your book. In the tradition of Roxane Gay's Hunger, a searing, honest, and candid exploration of what it's like to live as a fat man. So I went and looked up Roxane Gay, American writer, professor, editor. She wrote a book about hunger, struggling with obesity. And she said, you know, she asked the question, what it's like to live in a world that tried to discipline unruly bodies.
You know, that's a good line. Roxane's a very good writer.
Yeah, and so I wondered if you felt the same way, that you felt like your body was sort of unruly to you over the years.
Well, it certainly didn't do everything I wanted it to
right,
do.
Right, right. But you got a bunch of scenes in the book about playing basketball and moving around the basketball court.
You might not
have ridden a bike, but you could take a guy to the hoop, right?
I was certainly an athlete of sorts, right. Especially between the ages of about 13 and 25. So I was athletic. I played a lot of sports, did a lot of things like that. But even in those things, I was always limited by my weight. You know, I could play basketball, but if I was running full court, I would wear out pretty quick. But I think what Roxane is getting at a little bit is this sort of dichotomy that overweight people have with trying to lose weight and get in better shape. At least that's what most of us are doing. And also trying to get the world to sort of accept us as we are.
Right.
And not mock us and not, you know, say you should just lose weight and exercise, like that's so simple, you know. And so there is that sort of balance between trying to make yourself a better person and also trying to get other people to be better and how they relate to us.
She also said that the press around the book was very challenging for her because, and I like this quote, people don't know how to talk about fat. And I have to admit, coming into this and preparing for this interview, I was a little apprehensive myself about how to tackle the topic and,
sure.
and not trip over myself in the process. So have you found that that's a topic that people are uncomfortable talking about?
Well, sure. It was uncomfortable for me to talk about.
Sure. And I was going to ask you about that. This is your first book.
Yeah.
You've written forever. I mean, you're well renowned writer for the Observer for 23 years. You've gotten all these accolades, and I'm thinking, where's this book? You know, and then you come write this book, and the first one is going to be about yourself, a personal invasion of your own privacy.
Well, you know, it's like peeling off a Band-Aid, man. Just rip it all, you know, pull it all at once, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it is a difficult thing for people to discuss, either from the inside or the outside. Because it's one of the last, first of all, it's one of the last afflictions that I think people still feel comfortable making fun of.
Okay.
You know, there are fat jokes and there are fat characters on TV and things like that. And that,
so we hadn't reached the politically correct moment yet.
Exactly. Not for most people.
Okay.
So it's still like people are trying to figure out, is this something I can be humorous about or is it something I should just be very serious about?
And you do both in the book.
I do, yeah. But I also think it's, you know, people see obesity and they think of gluttony.
Right.
And which is sort of a gross and kind of disgusting thing to think about.
Or they think all this person needs to do is go to the gym and lose some weight.
There's that too. There's that whole idea of, you know, this is an easy thing to fix if you just want to fix it. The one thing I will say about, the other thing I'll say about being fat, excuse me, Landis, is that it is the one affliction that you can't hide. Mm. You know, if you're a drug addict or an alcoholic or a shoplifter or a gambler or whatever, you might be able to walk down the street and have nobody know that. You know, you could clean up nice, basically. If you're fat, there's no way
no hiding
that. And so it becomes a thing that, because it's so out there in the open, I think people feel like they can, even though it's an uncomfortable thing to think about, people feel like they can talk about it in a way that it's harder to talk about other things.
I was trolling around before this interview on your blog, and I found something you wrote March 1, 2016, and you said on that date that you just finished a book. I wrote a book. I think I'll go sleep for a couple of days.
Yeah.
Right. So that was March 1, 2016. It's not coming out until now.
Until January 2019. Well, part of that.
Right. January 2019.
Part of that is the publishing process.
Editorial process.
So on March 2016, I finished the first draft.
Okay, that's the first
draft. So I completed a draft of the book.
And for your, let's see, if anyone goes to your blog, they're going to find a picture of this little whiteboard that says elephant in the room, and you've got all these little chapters down there, and you've crossed through
it. I've crossed about,
After you write one, you cross through it. You know, as if
absolutely.
Something accomplished. But you're staring at this every day, and I wondered about that, staring at your own life, a part of your life that maybe you don't want to think about or talk about. Was that hard, looking at that every day?
Well, it was hard to sort
I'm assuming you wrote every day.
Pretty much every day, yeah. I had full-time work as a freelancer and all that going on. All this time too. It's funny, my wife and I had a conversation about this a couple weeks ago, and I was talking about my routine and I didn't really remember it very well. And what she said was, I would get up in the morning, I would have breakfast, and I would say, I'm gonna go write for a while. And so I'd go in my office and I would write for 4 hours maybe. Mm-hmm. And I'd come out and I'd have lunch, and then I would take a nap. I would go to bed and sleep for like 2 hours. I was sort of emotionally exhausted.
Decompress,
yeah. And then I would get up.
You didn't go watch sports? You went to bed?
I went to bed. I went to sleep. And then I would get up and work for a few more hours, sometimes on the book, sometimes on some, if I had a freelance assignment or something like that. And then that would be the end of the day. But it was so draining to me to write this that at the end of that every day's writing session, I was just wiped out.
All right, we've got six little short pieces here from the book you're going to read.
Okay.
We're going to start out with the opening. Get oriented here.
New Year's Eve, 2014. I weigh 460 pounds. Those are the hardest words I've ever had to write. Nobody knows that number. Not my wife, not my doctor, not my closest friends. It feels like confessing a crime. The average American male weighs 195 pounds. I'm two of those guys with a 10-year-old left over. I'm the biggest human being most people who know me have ever met or ever will. The government definition of obesity is a body mass index of 30 or more. My BMI is 60.7. My shirts are size XXXXXXL, which the big and tall stores shorten to 6X. I'm 6'1", or 73 inches tall. My waist is 60 inches around. I'm nearly a sphere. Those are the numbers. This is how it feels. Some days when I see that disaster staring back, I get so mad that I pound my gut with my fists, as if that would beat the fat out of me. Other times, the sight sinks me into a blue fog that can ruin an hour or a morning or a day. But most of the time, what I feel is sadness over how much of my life I've wasted. When I was a kid, I never climbed a tree or learned to swim. When I was in my 20s, I never took a girl home from a bar. Now I'm 50, and I've never hiked a mountain or ridden a skateboard or done a cartwheel. I missed out on so many adventures, so many good times, because I was too fat to try. Sometimes when I could have tried anyway, I didn't have the guts. I've done a lot of things I'm proud of, but I've never believed I could do anything truly great because I failed so many times at the one crucial challenge in my life. What the hell is wrong with me? I fight my cravings every day. My weight affects everything I do. It's going to kill me if I don't change. I've spent a lifetime telling other people's stories. My weight is the biggest story of my life. But I haven't told it because I was embarrassed, because I was afraid, because I knew I didn't understand myself. It's time to tell it. It's time to go to work. I'm on deadline.
So I like the movement back to the newsroom for a second. You're on the deadline.
Yeah. I'm used to deadlines.
You're used to deadlines. Give yourself a deadline. So there's a lot in this opening chapter. You come clean right off the bat. It's the hardest words you've ever had to write, your weight number, and then you talk about the things you missed out, and you talk about your cravings and the embarrassment. So how do you sort of put yourself out there like this? How did you come to terms with doing that?
Well, for a long time I didn't.
Right. You're certainly doing it now.
Yeah. I mentioned, in fact, my agent and I had a conversation at one point where I mentioned this as an idea for the book, for a book to write. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's absolutely yes, you ought to write that.
Okay.
And from that moment to the time I actually signed a contract to write the book, 3 years went by.
So you had a lot of time to think about it.
Well, there were 3 years where I was afraid to do it.
Okay.
I was just scared to write it. And what unlocked it for me was actually magazine story I did.
Yeah, I'm gonna have you read that.
Okay.
In fact, we just jump right to that. It's
okay.
It's on, I think it's on page 206 of your book. This was an article you wrote for ESPN the magazine.
That's right.
And you highlighted Jared Lorenzen. Is that right?
Yep. Former quarterback, University of Kentucky, played in the NFL, was known as the hefty lefty because he was often bigger than his linemen.
Right.
And when I found him, when I came across him, he was playing for a minor league football team, weighing somewhere north of 400 pounds.
Wow, like the fridge?
Like the fridge, but
from back
even
then.
More so.
Okay.
And so
I'm talking about refrigerator period.
From
the days of the Chicago Bears and the Super Bowl shuffle.
That's right. Yeah. And when I saw a little clip of Jared on SportsCenter, I thought he was somebody that I could identify with, and that there was probably nobody better suited than me to try to tell his story. So that's what I set out to do.
And so the little piece I'm going to have you read here starts with what happened after you wrote this piece and the feedback that you've got. Millions of people read it, so I'm going to have you start right there.
Okay. The piece ended up being one of ESPN's most viewed stories of 2014. Millions of people read it. Tens of thousands shared it on Facebook and Twitter. Hundreds of readers sent me letters. Some people shared intimate stories about their own struggles with weight. Others said they had a new understanding of what it's like to battle the temptation to overeat. For years, I'd been afraid to write about my own life as a fat guy. Writing about Jared helped me figure out a way. Reading those letters made me see it might mean something to other people. If not for that story, I wouldn't have written this book.
And I think, Tommy, because of the skill that you have in telling stories, that this book will impact people and will have some meaning, not just for people that are struggling themselves, but for people that don't necessarily understand, you know, the person who is concerned about whether the guy's going to sit in the middle seat, you know, on a plane, or, you know, they walk into a room, you know, just trying to deal with other people's perceptions is I hope is going to going to have an effect here too. So you got that courage because you wrote about somebody else.
I wrote about somebody else, and it made me kind of see how I could write this story about myself.
Okay. But what got this started, or what always gets it started, I suppose, with obesity is food. And before we talk about fast food, I want to talk about the food that you grew up with.
Okay. Sure.
You read this to the Charlotte Writers Club when you spoke to us when you were in the stages of working on it. And I liked it so much then, I immediately went and looked for it before we came here today. So you're going to start with Everybody in My Family.
Okay. Everybody in my family was an artist when it came to Southern food. The women cooked the most, but the men could swing a meal now and then. Daddy's specialty was chicken and dumplings, with the dumplings made from crumbled up soda crackers. The show of the year was the family reunion at Uncle Ted and Aunt Estelle's house in Nahunta, Georgia, which is known, if it's known, for once hosting the World Armadillo Olympics. Uncle Ted worked in the pulp mills and played country blues on his guitar. Aunt Estelle, my dad's sister, was rough as a cob. From the time I was about 10, every time we showed up, she'd take one look at me and holler, "You ain't lost no weight." And then she would call us to the kitchen where we would add our dishes to heaven's buffet. Most of the time, the center of the table was a platter of fried chicken piled so high it would topple if you pulled out the wrong leg. There'd be pork chops, turkey and dressing, beef stew, maybe venison if it was hunting season. Then the white food group, mashed potatoes, potato salad, deviled eggs, rice with brown gravy, biscuits and cornbread shining with butter, and then the vegetables, Crowder peas and Kentucky Wonder pole beans, crookneck squash and fried okra, turnip greens and salty pot liquor, sliced tomatoes picked 5 minutes ago. This paragraph is as close as I will ever come to writing porn.
Okay, so there's some great lines. My mother used to always talk about whether the water was rough as a cob or not. I love that line.
Oh, thank you, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, good southern line there.
Now, you know, that's from the old outhouse days when, when the corn cob was...
I don't think that's what she was thinking about. it's whether the water is flat or kicking up.
Right.
But in your last line, I love it. Paragraph is as close as I'll ever come to writing porn. Did you see food growing up as something as lustful as sex? I mean, is it that?
I wouldn't say I thought of it that way, but certainly until I had sex, I experienced it that way. You know, I guess I'll put it this way. I don't like food better than sex. I never have.
Right.
But there is a nearly erotic pleasure to really good food. You know, a good meal, especially with friends, something like family or something where all these people have come together and made this incredible spread for one another's enjoyment. People talk about a food orgy, you know, something like that. That's kind of the idea.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's certainly an exquisite pleasure in, you know, a well-cooked piece of chicken or a really good squash casserole or whatever you want to talk about. Certainly those Southern foods that I grew up with is about as close as you can come, you know, without taking your clothes off.
Okay, so when we come back with Tommy Tomlinson, we're going to be talking about dieting and how Tommy used to cheat on his wife, Alex, but it's not exactly what you think. Hang with us and you'll find out more about what I'm talking about. While we've got a short break in the show, I'd like to share some information about the North Carolina Writers Network. I recently had a chance to catch up with Deanna Kelly Said, membership coordinator of the network. She's also a writer and storyteller herself. Here's what she had to say about the benefits of being a member of that organization.
The North Carolina Writers Network gives you immediate access to a large community of writers across various disciplines, and you could potentially come in contact and have conversations and learn from writers you would not meet otherwise. We have about 1,400 members throughout the state and beyond, and Many of our members are those who are shaping literary culture, and it's such a resource for writers. Even if you're a beginning writer, you're able to tap into this abundant source of knowledge and contacts, and you can build a community of those who will support you during your writing process and will help you celebrate when you have a literary success.
For more information, you can find a link to the network's website on our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. We're back with Tommy Tomlinson, author of The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. Tommy, the topic of dieting, I'm sure, comes up a lot when you talk about obesity, and you have something to say about that in your book. I'd like you to read this one little segment.
Sure. The only thing a trendy diet will help you lose is money. I've come to believe there's just one true plan that works in the long term. I call it the three-step diet. Step one, find a way to measure the calories you eat and drink. Step two, find a way to measure the calories you burn. Step three, make sure that every day, number one is smaller than number two. This doesn't have to cost you a dime. There are loads of free tools online and at the library to help you count calories in and calories out. I didn't know until I got serious about keeping track that there's a thing called basal metabolic rate, the calories your body burns just to keep your blood flowing and your lungs pumping air. You can find BMR calculators online, and they're all just a guess. A doctor can get you a more precise reading, but in general, the bigger you are, the more it takes to keep the engine running. I burn somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 calories a day just to stay alive. Right now I'm a Chevy Tahoe. I'd like to be a Prius.
Great image there at the end, Tommy. Do you think that people who aren't struggling with obesity realize the physiological factors that are involved for many people that are struggling?
Well, the short answer is no. I think part of the reason for that is that we're just learning what gaining weight and dieting and all those things do to your body. Some studies are showing, I believe I illustrate one in this book, that if you gain a lot of weight and then you lose weight, your body fights that because your body has come to believe that whatever weight you were at was the weight you're supposed to be at. Mm. And so as you lose weight, your body's metabolism slows down, which is almost the opposite of what you would expect, because it's trying to force you to keep putting on weight. Our bodies are very much still in the caveman days, right, when we had to eat to survive. So our bodies don't understand that we have an incredible abundance of food, most of us, that we can eat every day. Our bodies always think winter's coming, and we have to save up like a squirrel eating nuts or something. And so our bodies don't really understand when we're trying to lose weight that it's okay for us to get smaller. Our bodies are always trying to make us bigger because it's worried that we won't have enough to eat in the future.
Of course, when the cavemen were out hunting for their food, they didn't run into 12 fast food restaurants on the way either.
They did not. And I don't think obesity was a problem in the cavemen days.
Which leads us into this next segment where you're cheating on Alix. I'd like you to start the chapter on page 95 that you've titled Grease is the Word.
I cheat on my wife with a redhead named Wendy. Her place is just a couple miles from our house. She's always smiling when I pull up. She gives me exactly what I want. Every time I leave, I swear I won't come back. I keep coming back. Wendy is my favorite, but she's not my only one. Sometimes I go across town for a quickie with a guy in a clown suit named Ronald. Fast food is my deepest addiction. Since I was 16 and got my first car, I've spent endless hours idling in drive-through lanes, waiting to trade my money for my fix. I did some deeply depressing calculations one afternoon and figured out that I've spent at least $30 a week on fast food for the last 35 years. That comes to somewhere around $55,000. Fuck. That's enough for a bass boat or a new kitchen, with some left over to stash in the bank. Instead, I've invested it in Big Macs and Big Pans. If you're addicted to anything and want to get one solid measure of how much it's hurt your life, do the math.
Tommy, you talk about the fast food at great length in this book and what it's done to the weight in this country and to people individually. But your mistress here, Wendy, I found it amusing that she could tell what you wanted to order just by your voice.
Oh, there's one Wendy's that's the closest one to our house. Yeah. That I apparently had gone through enough that when I started to make my order one day, the woman at the, you know, at the microphone finished it off for me. She knew what I was going to order.
Kind of a wake-up call there, right?
To my horror, I'd become a regular.
Yeah.
And the truth is, I'd become a regular way before then, but it just was not so obvious and apparent to me. They knew me at least by my voice and knew what I wanted.
But you worked hard, and you viewed those receipts as kind of like chits the longer you held them in your pocket and didn't go back. Yeah.
I would, every time I would say I'm gonna beat this,
right,
then I would go to a fast food joint and I would save the receipt because I told myself this is gonna be the last time,
right,
I ever go to this place, and I want a memento of the last time I went to a fast food joint. And then I would go again like the next day. Right. And I'd throw out the older receipt and keep the new one and right, say I was going to start over.
Well, I'm not going to reveal to the readers more about your receipts. They can find out about that in the book. But one of the things that I noticed here is that you would get a lot of unsolicited advice over the years. I'd like you to turn to page 137.
Eat less and exercise. That's what some of you are saying right now. That's what some of you have said the whole time you've been reading this book. That's what some of you say, maybe not out loud, but you say it. Every time you see a fat person downing fried eggs in a diner, or overstuffing a bathing suit on the beach, or staring out for one of those, good Lord, what happened to her stories in the gossip magazines. Eat less and exercise. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Thank you for the advice. We will take that under consideration. Me and Sean and Oprah and all the millions of others like us. Eat less and exercise. Such a simple thing. What I want you to understand more than anything else is that telling a fat person eat less and exercise is like telling a boxer don't get hit. You act as if there's not an opponent. Losing weight is a fucking rock fight. The enemies come from all sides. The deluge of marketing telling us to eat worse and eat more. The culture that has turned food into one of the last acceptable vices. Our families and friends who want us to share in their pleasure. Our own body chemistry dragging us back to the table out of fear that we'll starve. On top of all that, some of us fight holes in our souls that a boxcar of donuts couldn't fill.
The struggle that you're dealing with, you alluded to the grandmother early on. You hadn't lost any weight and so forth and so on. It's like, I really don't need that advice. I think I got that piece of it.
That part of it, if you have some practical advice,
right,
some specific advice, I'm always glad to hear it. But just
not eat less.
I've got that one down.
Yeah, you got that one down. Okay, so before we shift to something else here that we're going to do, I found I identified with this because, and this is what I wrote down, the hardest thing to kick. Probably not for you, but I wrote it down because, yeah, you've got it in here too. It was hardest for you too. I'm going to have you read that because when I was 50, I was having some trouble with caffeine and I had to give up caffeine. And this was one of the hardest things for me to kick at that time.
The hardest thing to kick has been sweet tea. I am a lifelong Southerner. Sweet tea is our blood type. So I'm giving myself a gradual transfusion of unsweet tea and Coke Zero and water. So far, my body has not rejected these foreign substances.
And they are foreign compared to some good old sweet tea.
Oh, man, sweet tea, that's the toughest one.
Yeah.
That's been really hard for me because, you know, it's just at every table, at every diner. And sweet tea now,
it's like pouring syrup in something, right?
Well, yeah, but the other thing is, depending on where you go, sweet tea is now available everywhere. Like McDonald's, sell sweet tea everywhere.
Yeah, but there is a sweet tea line. You know this, don't you?
There is a sweet tea line. And in fact, one of the stories I always wanted to do as a magazine writer is to find out precisely where it was.
Well, we got close when our daughter was looking at colleges. She wanted to go look north. And I think we got just beyond Richmond. We were coming around the corner up there. And believe it or not, that's still, we would consider that south, but you have to start using sweet and low or something at that point.
Yeah, I would say somewhere north of Richmond
right.
and below D.C. is a sweet tea line.
You need to go find that and get a surveyor.
I'm telling you, so, somebody out there now, if you'll give me somebody to write that story, I'll be glad to do it.
Yeah, that's great. All right, before we go to the last piece, because you've been doing other things, I want to ask you quickly. You're a podcaster now, Southbound.
I am, yes, Southbound on through WFAE.
Have you enjoyed that? Yeah,
I have. It's been a new thing for me. Obviously, as anybody who's listening to this can tell, I have this kind of weird voice.
Which I write
about in the book as to how I ended up with it. And so I was very surprised when somebody suggested that I could do a podcast. Well, the great thing about podcasts is there are many, many different types of voices out there. And so as I talked with WFAE about doing some work for them, we came around to talking about this podcast. And as we're having this conversation now, in November, I've just finished doing the podcast for a year.
Great.
So I have a year's worth of episodes. It's been a blast. I've
learned. Well, I would commend it to anyone who hasn't heard it yet. Go listen. I've listened to it, and I really enjoy the conversational style that you've got going there.
Oh, well, thank you, Lance. I appreciate it.
We're going to do something real quick, and then you're going to read a piece about music, because music is one of the things you love, even though Alex only likes Neil Diamond, right?
not only Neil Diamond, but,
but I mean, but
certainly
but that's
Neil
how
Diamond.
You compare and contrast.
Yeah. So I'll tell you, you talked about the sacrifices we make for each other.
Yeah.
I guess early this year, maybe it was last year now, I went with her to see Neil Diamond.
Oh, my gosh.
And,
well, I went with my wife to Harry Potter World.
So. Oh, there you go. Yeah, so, see, we all make these little sacrifices. He did he did like 12 courses of Sweet Caroline. So it was entertaining.
All right. So I'm calling this first draft. You can tell me a little bit to find out about you as a writer, your style. You get a choice. You can pick one or the other or both or neither, and then you can editorialize if you want. Ink, pen, or keyboard?
Keyboard.
All right. Poetry or prose? I think I know this.
Prose.
Yeah, prose.
Although I do love poetry, but I'm not a good poet. Yeah.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Mostly nonfiction these days.
Yeah. Morning or night?
My goal is the morning.
You like to write
in the morning? I'm better in the morning, but often I end up writing at night.
Okay. Outline or free flow?
I'm sort of a hybrid. I've never really written on a strong outline. I tend to write in sort of chunks.
Writing or editing? You like the first draft better than the second or third draft? Or do you like it all?
You know, I have to say, I really have come to enjoy editing and polishing and making something better, making a gem out of a rock.
Cool. Library or Google?
Well, my heart says library, but my day-to-day routine says Google.
Dictionary or spell check?
Spell check.
Introvert or extrovert?
I consider myself to be an introvert. I've had to teach myself to be an extrovert, to do the things that I've wanted to do for a living.
Right. E-reader or paper book?
Paper book all day.
Social media or personal appearances?
Much prefer personal appearances.
Yeah.
Although I'm out there on social media.
You got a little Twitter account with a very recent picture of yourself on there.
Yeah, from the time I was, I think it was maybe fourth grade.
Yeah. All right, last question, marketing or manual labor?
Well, manual labor. I don't want to. Yeah. What's the guy in Say Anything? I don't want to buy or sell anything that's processed.
Right. Please don't buy my book. You know.
Yeah. Well, I'm not good. I'll do it if necessary, but I'd rather probably go chop wood.
My dad sold encyclopedias in high school, and the neighbors said to his parents, "You know, Ham came by and he was going to sell these encyclopedias, but when he got to the door, he said, 'Y'all don't want to buy any of these encyclopedias, do you?'" So we've got one last piece here you're going to read. It has nothing to do with obesity or being fat or your struggle to write this book or all the good it's going to do for people who read it. This is just a good old fun story about music, and it involves maybe little known because it's been a while, but this fellow is from Charlotte, Sammy Johns, and he wrote a You wrote a song that you identified with as a young teenager, probably, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. And so I'm going to have you read Chevy Van.
Okay. And this book is, I mean, this story is in a book called, I think it's called Making Notes, Music of the Carolinas. It's available at your local bookstore through Amazon. It's a group of essays about Carolina music. Lots of people will tell you they've always had great taste in music. They'll say they latched onto Springsteen in first grade, that they played Dylan for Kids at the Pool, that they spent their first chunk of allowance money on Kind of Blue. These people are liars. Kids listen to junk. It's the same impulse that makes them crave cotton candy. When our taste buds are young, all we want is a sweet rush that melts on the tongue and puts one thought in our mind. Again. Which brings me to a song called Chevy Van by a Charlotte boy named Sammy Johns. In the summer of 1975, to my 11-year-old mind, there were two great American record labels, KTEL and Ronco. They crammed 20 hits onto a single LP and sold it for $4.98. A slab of vinyl can't hold as much as a CD, so every song had something edited out. The third verse, or the keyboard solo, or the long fade at the end. In almost every case, this made the song better. I'm imagining some guy at the Ronco splicing machine thinking, the Beatles got in and out in 2 minutes and 15 seconds. I'll be damned if Paul Anka gets more than that. Because of the sweet, glorious internet, I'm now looking at the track listing for a record I bought the summer when I was 11. If I'm remembering right, it is the second LP I ever bought. It is a fine KTEL production titled Music Express. Chevy Van is track 9, side 1. The record leads off with Love Will Keep Us Together, the Captain and Tennille's mega hit, the best-selling record of the entire year. And because this is a personal essay, and you should be honest in personal essays, I will now tell you that back then, I belonged to the Captain and Tennille fan club. Actually, it could have been a lifetime membership, so I might still be in. We members got a special 8x10 photo of the Captain and Tennille with their bulldogs. If you tell anyone this, I will track you down and kill you. We'll get to Chevy Van, I promise. But first, let me list the other tracks on Music Express by category. Songs I still like enough to have on my iPod 32 years later. Get Down Tonight by KC and the Sunshine Band. Songs that still sort of hold up. I'm Not in Love by 10cc. Jackie Blue by the Ozark Mountain Daredevils. The Rockford Files theme by Mike Post. A Long Train Running by the Doobie Brothers. Songs I probably shouldn't like but still do. Cats in the Cradle by Harry Chapin. And Swearing to God by Frankie Valli. Songs I used to like, but it turns out I was wrong. Love Will Keep Us Together. Philadelphia Freedom by Elton John. Mandy by Barry Manilow. Poetry Man by Phoebe Snow. Sky High by Jigsaw. My Eyes Adored You by Frankie Valli. Again. Songs I don't remember anymore. Brazil by the Ritchie Family. Dynamite by Tony Camillo's Bazooka. Black Superman by Johnny Wakelin and the Kinshasa Band. Songs that even at age 11 sucked. Run Joey Run by David Geddes. Rocky by Austin Roberts. And Get Dancin' by Disco Tex and the Sexolettes. If you're around my age and you're realizing that this is a fair sampling of the music you loved when you were 11, part of you might have been wishing that when you were 10, you had fallen down a well. But as Woody Allen said in a totally different and really creepy context, the heart wants what it wants. Which brings us back to Chevy Van. On YouTube, there's a sad little video of Chevy Van. Video is not even the right word. The only image is a still photo of a Sammy Johns album cover. He's dressed in the full 70s singer-songwriter uniform. Longish hair, matching beard and mustache, wide-collared shirt open two or three buttons down. The opening act for Dan Fogelberg. But the song doesn't sound right. It's a remake he did somewhere along the way. Poke around a little more and you find another video. A shirtless guy in a Hams beer cap goofing around on a farm. It's your basic YouTube special made for 99 cents and some weed, but the background music is the original Chevy van. It starts to play, and in my brain, a drawer opens and the words of music come tumbling out. I gave a girl a ride in my wagon. There's not much to it. A couple of layered guitars, some nice harmonies, a keyboard of some kind tugging at the chorus. But it all flows together, as shallow and pretty as a trout stream, and Sammy reaches for the high notes as if he knew when he wrote it, this one's got a chance. She was tired, 'cause her mind was a dragon. I said, get some sleep and dream of rock and roll. I should stop right here and admit the best thing about this song back when I was 11. Sammy got some, right there in his Chevy van. My dad drove a Chevy van back then, mostly to haul around his tools, but I could and did imagine giving a girl a ride, and shortly thereafter, 2 minutes and 48 seconds later, if the song was any indication, getting some of my own. Although I wasn't sure how to get some, or how much I needed to be getting, or exactly what some was. When I was 11, there was a lot I didn't know. One of the things I didn't know was how hard it was to write something that's simple and pure and sticks with people 35 years down the road. 'Cause like a picture she was laying there, moonlight dancing off her hair. She woke up and took me by the hand. She's gonna love me in my Chevy van, and that's all right with me. Chevy Van sold more than 1 million copies and made it to number 5 on the pop charts. It was the only time Sammy Johns made the top 40. 20 years later, I was a music writer in Charlotte, and Sammy Johns was trying to make a comeback. He came by the newspaper for an interview. He had written a few hits for country singers, Waylon Jennings, Conway Twitty, but wanted another shot on his own. He knew he had a better chance living in Nashville, but he decided he liked it better in Shelby. That was the last I heard of him. As far as I know, he's still knocking around, and he may well be writing his giant comeback hit at this very moment. But chances are that his gift to the world at large is one song, a shade under 3 minutes long, that they played on the radio 3 decades ago. I've been listening to Chevy Van over and over as I've been writing this, 10 or 12 times in a row, and I keep expecting to get sick of it, the way most of us get sick of the music we used to love before we became mature and smart and cool, the way grown men and women lose the taste for cotton candy. But instead, I keep pressing play, keep clicking and listening and writing, and somewhere in all this, I turned 11 years old again. And Chevy Van is playing on my KTEL album on my Sears Roebuck stereo. And Spun Sugar melts so good on my tongue. And that's all right with me.
That's great, Tommy.
Thank you.
I know you had fun writing that.
Yeah, and Sammy has since passed away. I wrote that several years ago, and he's passed away since then, but I remember him and that song fondly.
Well, I have to confess, when I read this in preparing for the podcast, I couldn't resist. I went on YouTube last night, and I listened to every single one of the songs.
I feel sorry for you, Landis. That's more than I've done.
That's because some of them I didn't recognize, you know, from the titles. And
sure.
I went back, and you're right. A couple of these... really Rocky and Run Joey Run. I mean, come on, those are just
Rocky is. I think people think it's like the Rocky.
It's not the Rocky theme. That's what I thought you were dissing on the Rocky theme.
No. It's about some. Yeah. It's like a young girl who gets cancer and dies. It's a terrible one of those weepers.
But the video that the one that pops up on YouTube of the Captain's Neil, your fan club. Love Will Keep Us Together. It's got this huge screen behind it, and all these people were in these 1970s clothes and halter tops and bell bottoms and everything.
It's a throwback.
It's interesting, but one person, I scrolled down to look at the reviews, and one person says, "Absolutely beautiful. I love the 70s." And this other person says, "I remember the radio station rotated this song three times a day with Wildfire and Afternoon Delight until I thought I was going to throw up."
That's quite a trifecta.
Yeah, that was. So music has been a part of your life, and you've written about it. Good singing there.
Not good singing, but it's some. I can't hit Sammy's high notes, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, look, Tommy. When I was a young lawyer here in Charlotte, I had the pleasure of reading your columns. It always put me in a good mood when I was having to go to that deposition with the adversary who wasn't going to behave. And, you know, you just tell a great story and you tell it personally. And I think what people are going to relate to here is that you've taken those same storytelling skills and you've applied them to your own life, which I suppose is what makes a good memoir when you can do that.
Well, I hope so, sure.
Yeah, and you can't hide from the truth, and you haven't done that. Listeners, you're gonna get not only a great read, but you're gonna find out a lot of things about a great writer who's willing to be honest about a very difficult topic. And I wanna commend you for that and thank you for that, and again, appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Lannis. Thanks for bringing me on, and thanks for making me sing.
Well, that's it for today. Another fine author giving voice to their written words. If you liked our show, we'd very much appreciate your help in spreading the word. You can do that by telling your friends, or by leaving a review on iTunes, also known as Apple Podcasts, or by connecting with us on social media. Our social media links are at our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. If you sign up for our email list at our website, you get a free ebook, a novel written by your host. And by the way, if you do sign up for our email list, we promise not to spam you. Just send you periodic updates about the show. Next week, we'll have another interesting author read and talk about their work. I hope you will join us. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.